It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, new legislation would boost CPR education in Wisconsin schools. We'll hear from the American Heart Association.
First, it's our weekly look at the latest in national politics with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. The markets have been in decline since the start of the year, and we'll take a look at what this could mean for the presidential race.
And Bernie Sanders has been closing in on Hillary Clinton as we approach the Iowa caucuses, and a big endorsement from Sarah Palin for Donald Trump. Does any of this change what's going to happen in Iowa?
Harry Enten joins us now. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start by talking about the economy. Now, the Dow dropped 500 points today. It's been on the decline since the beginning of the year. Now, of course, a big part of conventional wisdom is that people vote based on how their personal budgets are doing, sort of a bigger picture of how the economy is doing. So what kind of effect is this, do you think, having right now in the presidential race, in the political landscape?
Right. And I think we should be clear that, you know, many people don't have a lot of money in the stock market, if any money at all. So obviously no one wants to see the stock market falling, but we tend to look at other factors to understand how the economy will affect the presidential race, such as jobs, such as income, such as how people are feeling about the economy itself, and a number of polls ask that. And the job market is actually doing better than it once was. Obviously, it's not doing as well as I think some people want, but we're gaining many jobs, many more than we were gaining, say, 4 to 8 years ago. If we look at economic confidence, it's been rising, but not nearly as fast as perhaps it would in a truly great recovery. Basically, when you look at the economic picture as a whole, you do see that there is some gains being made, which would suggest good news for the Democrats, but not enough of a gain that, say, if Hillary Clinton became the Democrat nominee, that she would be any sort of a shoe. And it's basically 50-50 each way.
So at what point does the average person who maybe does not have money in the stock market, at what point do they get a little nervous?
I think they get nervous if they notice, you know, that they're getting fired. I think they notice if the unemployment rate is going up, if they notice that the jobs being gained are going down, if they notice that they're maybe not getting as much of a raise as they did last year. Those are the types of things that most voters are going to be paying attention to. And right now, there isn't a lot to suggest that the declining stock market is changing voters' perception on the economy as a whole. But, of course, it may take some time. And I think one of the key things that we should point out is that studies from past elections point out it's really the economy, how the economy is doing closest to the election, how it's doing a year before doesn't make that much of an impact. It's really in the final few months, final 6 months, how the economy is doing. That's what we really will need to pay attention to.
Yeah, I mean, there's that old expression, it's the economy, stupid, but is there a point at which the economy is just kind of a meh and everything else trumps that? For example, national security, things like that?
Sure. I mean, you know, if you're in a situation where I think we are right now, if you sort of look at all the economic indicators where the economy isn't doing so well that it's going to be the thing that saved the Democrats, doing so poorly that it's the thing that would doom Hillary Clinton if she were to win, there are other things that we would look at. And so, you know, where the parties stand on national security, where the parties stand on foreign policy, where the parties even would stand on stuff like the environment. All of these things obviously make an impact on the election. It's just they're usually muted because the economy is such an important part of the election. But if the economy keeps going as it is right now, which is good but not great, then those other things could be much more important factors this time around.
Well, right now we've got these falling oil prices. We've got the slowdown of the Chinese economy. Not a lot that you can lay exactly at the doorstep of the White House, for example. So how are politicians talking about the economy right now?
Yeah, you know, one of the funny things is that voters aren't as that smart to necessarily figure out, you know, who is to blame for the economy and who isn't to blame for the economy. You know, it could be, hey, you got in the White House at the wrong time. It was really the last president's tax cuts or tax hikes that made the difference for this given president. But then that president really is just, for lack of a better term, screwed by the conditions that were left by his or her predecessor. But what we're essentially seeing is that the Republicans are saying, look, the economy's bad. We're going to make America great again, to quote Donald Trump, while, you know, Hillary Clinton saying, look, the economy is doing better. There are still parts of the economy we'd obviously like to fix. And Bernie Sanders has certainly picked that up in terms of income inequality. So no one's on either side claiming that the economy is doing fantastically. But on the Democratic side, it's a little more bright than it is on the Republican side.
We're talking national politics right now with senior political writer and analyst for 538, Harry Enten. And Harry, let's get into the horse racing aspect of the political race right now, the presidential race. And 538 recently announced predictions for the primaries. Looking at Iowa, what are you seeing there?
Well, we're seeing two separate pictures. On the Republican side at this point, and I should clarify, we have two different forecasts that are going on. One that looks at only the state polls, and then we have a polls plus forecast that looks at other factors that in the past have usually, though not always, helped to improve the accuracy of the forecast. And on the Democratic side, what we see are both the polls forecast and the polls plus the additional sauce both favor Hillary Clinton, although only by a small margin, with Bernie Sanders gaining, although that gain perhaps has not been as much in the last week as it was 2 weeks ago. And then on the Republican side, what we see is a real split. If you look at only the polls, you see pretty much a dead heat between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. If you add the little extra sauce, then you see Ted Cruz with a little over a 50% chance of winning, while Trump is more towards 30% versus, if you just look at the polls, they're both right around 40%. So on both sides, we have a race that we can't really be sure who's going to win. But on the Democratic side, Clinton's a slight bit more of a favorite than, say, Ted Cruz or Donald Trump would be on the Republican side.
Looking at this through the lens of history, does that surprise you for where we are right now?
I think it does, at least on the Republican side, a little bit more than the Democratic side. Look, Iowa and New Hampshire are states that oftentimes, especially Iowa, doesn't necessarily predict who's going to win. But usually the candidate who ends up winning is in the top two, and if not the top two, then the top three or four. And if you're looking at the Republican side right now, historically, neither someone like a Donald Trump nor a Ted Cruz would look like candidates that Republicans usually nominate. But it's very difficult to dismiss the fact that it's not just in Iowa where Cruz and Trump are doing well. It's in New Hampshire. It's in South Carolina. But in the past, also, we know if you go back to the Democrats in 2004, there can be a lot of change in the final 2 weeks of the campaign. So just because Trump and Cruz are at the top right now, don't be shocked if there's some third person who comes out of nowhere to win. Not saying that's going to happen, but it is possible looking at history.
And would you be starting to sniff that third person out in the polls by now?
Yeah, we would probably get a pretty good idea of the polls that are coming out this week and then obviously especially in the next. There haven't been as many polls conducted in Iowa, at least not released to the public, over the last week, so it makes it a little more difficult to sniff that out. But we should start to see that. You know, it won't be one giant movement at once, but instead of, say, polling at, you know, 20, if they're going to end up at 25% and they were initially polling at 10%, you wouldn't expect them to be at 25 this week, but you might see them increase to 15, and then that doubles to 20 next week, and then to 25 when the votes are actually cast and counted.
Well, hopscotching over to New Hampshire for just a moment, there was a poll that I saw you tweeting about that had Bernie Sanders looking like he was consolidating a pretty big lead over Hillary Clinton there. You thought that was an outlier, but do you want to talk about that a little bit, what that could mean?
Yeah, you know, New Hampshire has been the state that I think most people looking at this, if Bernie Sanders was going to win a state outside of Vermont, that they expect him to win, it would be New Hampshire. New Hampshire is obviously right next door to Vermont. A lot of undeclared independents vote in that primary, and they are favoring Bernie Sanders heavily. The particular poll that I was referencing and that you just referenced was a poll from the University of New Hampshire that had Sanders up by an amazing 27 percentage points. Our own forecast has the lead at about a third of that, around 10 points. I think it might be closer to 12, our exact forecast. But it's clear that Sanders is winning there. Now, whether or not if he ends up winning there, we don't know. If Clinton were to win in Iowa, that affects what happens in New Hampshire. And then you go down to a state like South Carolina, which is heavily African-American on the Democratic side, and Hillary Clinton does very well among African-American Democrats. So we can't say if whether Sanders wins New Hampshire, it's a game changer. But obviously, Clinton would prefer Sanders not to win New Hampshire, but he clearly has, at least according to our forecast, a better than 50% chance of doing so at this time.
Now, you were in Iowa last week. What did you see on the ground there that maybe confirmed or called into question what you're seeing in your numbers so far?
You know, one of the things that really struck, I think, everyone here at the staff was how much better organized, at least on the ground, the Democrats were. They had a lot more field offices, a lot more people working in those field offices than the Republicans were. The Republican campaigns, we visited a few offices where there really were, you know, not very many people. There was one office we visited where there were only three people in the office at the time. So, you know, and I should also note that we couldn't get into some of those offices. Donald Trump's people wouldn't even allow us to take a look inside. But we did get a picture outside of the office in which we all look great. But, you know, the thing that really struck was that the whole idea of a ground game in Iowa on the Republican side is probably overrated. None of them really have a great ground game. Maybe Ted Cruz has the best of any of them, but none of them really have a good ground game on the Republican side.
So another news from yesterday from the campaign trail, Sarah Palin came out, endorsed Donald Trump, which surprised you not at all, Harry. How come?
Well, Sarah Palin is always in the business of entertaining people, I guess, so I don't think it was so surprising that she endorsed the most entertaining political character to come along in the American political scene and for forever. But in reality, why it really didn't surprise me was three things. One, Sarah Palin has taken on a very anti-establishment tone. I don't think there's anyone who's more anti-establishment than Donald Trump. Two, there's this idea that's floating out there that Sarah Palin is this great sort of conservative leader. But in fact, Sarah Palin's record hasn't been all that conservative when it comes to stuff like immigration or feminism, a whole host of issues. So Donald Trump perhaps not having this great conservative record really didn't keep her from endorsing him, because she's really been always more about being anti-establishment. And the third, both Palin and Trump are loved by the people that like them and hated by the people that don't. They're very divisive. And so Palin getting behind someone who is as divisive as she is, simply put, is just not all that surprising.
And Trump saying, yes, there would be a place for Sarah Palin on my cabinet if I'm elected president, does that mean a VP shot is out of the question?
I would be very surprised if there was a VP slot for Sarah Palin for Donald Trump. But, you know, I have to be honest with you. I think a lot of us have made fools of ourselves saying that Donald Trump can't do this, Donald Trump can't do that. So the idea that I would dismiss him picking anybody as vice president at this point would simply be foolish.
And lastly, the Supreme Court announced that it's going to take up the challenge to President Obama's action on immigration. Give us a sense of what's riding on that case.
Well, you know, let me talk about the politics for a second. You know, there are a lot of Republicans who have argued that President Obama has used his pen without going to Congress to whether you know, on executive decisions, executive actions, whatever, has overstepped his authority. And they have argued that to the base over and over again, and they've certainly tried to argue it to the general electorate. And the Supreme Court so far really has not been so friendly to Republicans. You know, they upheld the Affordable Health Care Act. They were, you know, they've done so twice. And a lot of Republican voters are very upset with the Supreme Court. So this action right here going into an election year, especially when it comes to immigration, and remember, there are a lot of Latinos in the state of Florida, it could make a difference in terms of how voters perceive the parties. And Republicans obviously wish for Obama to be told, you've overstepped your bounds. But the Supreme Court so far, even though it's probably a 5-4 edge in favor of the Republicans, Anthony Kennedy and John Roberts haven't actually acted as the way I think most Republicans would like them to act. So we'll have to see what happens.
Harry, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time with the latest in national politics. CPR education would be expanded in Wisconsin schools under a bill currently before the state legislature. If passed, the law would require CPR education and health classes in 7th to 12th grade, and the law would apply to public, private, and charter schools.
The American Heart Association supports that legislation. Two representatives from the group join us now. Dr. J. Carter Ralph is chief of the Division of Pediatric Cardiology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and co-director of UW Health's Pediatric Heart Program. He's board president for the American Heart Association in Madison. Dr. Ralph, thanks for joining us today.
Great. Thanks for having us.
And Nicole Hudzinski is Senior Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association in Wisconsin. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, Nicole, can you sum up this legislation for us? We just gave a quick nutshell version, but what would change?
So the bill will embed basic CPR training in the health curriculum. So anytime that a student takes a health class between 7th and 12th grade, they will spend one of those class periods learning basic compressions-only CPR, which I think is really important to point out is different from full certification. It's not what we're asking our clinicians or EMS providers to have. It's a much more basic training, exposing the students to CPR, teaching them what they need to know in order to step in a cardiac emergency.
And this is, as I understand it, about a half hour-ish of training for the students.
Exactly. Half an hour or at least one class period.
So, Dr. Ralph, talk us through the benefits of providing this kind of training for students.
They're really profound. Currently, heart disease and heart attacks and cardiac arrest is the leading cause of death in America. About 1,000 people a day in America die of cardiac arrest. And most of them don't get CPR. There aren't bystanders available who know how to provide CPR or are comfortable in providing CPR. So in training the students of Wisconsin, we will provide over 50,000, about 58,000 students a year will graduate from schools understanding the basics of CPR, and they may be then be in a position to provide life-saving treatment if somebody needs it. Other states that have approved this have found a dramatic increase in the survivor ability of cardiac arrest. Currently, it's about 11% nationally. In states that have approved this type of training and where this training has been implemented effectively, the survivorship have gone up dramatically, 25%,
wow.
35%.
So more than doubling.
Yes.
And it just having a pool of people, enough people out there that there's a decent chance that one of those bystanders will have this training makes that difference.
Right. Think about it. 58,000 people a year throughout the state of Wisconsin. And this is throughout the state. It's not just in urban centers or where the population is, but this is throughout all the rural centers as well. So these are people that are available. And it's such straightforward and simple training, this 30 minutes. And it's really about overcoming your apprehension to do something. Because if you don't know, it's a shocking, horrible thing to see. But the fact that you've had some training, even if it's several years ago, might be just enough to get you to step in and take action. And that alone will save lives.
And Nicole, Dr. Ralph just mentioned other states doing this. This is something that is fairly common. Wisconsin would be doing something, I guess, fairly similar to what other states are doing.
Exactly. There are currently 27 other states who have passed similar legislation embedding CPR in the health or additional curriculum.
And Dr. Ralph, how difficult is CPR to learn nowadays? Is this something that a middle schooler, a high schooler can handle?
Yes, absolutely. What we've learned over time is that this basic hands-only compressions is enough to provide and secure circulation. So what we're trying to do is maintain blood flow, because blood flow helps deliver oxygen. And the key is to deliver that to the brain to help prevent brain damage from cardiac arrest. The other key is to provide blood flow into the heart itself. And it turns out that chest compressions alone work. You know, we used to all learn the full-scale CPR used to be a two-day training process to get certified, where you had to give breaths as well, and you had to count compressions and count breaths. And people found that kind of complicated. In fact, I still find it complicated to remember. Is it 15 to 2, whatever? In this case, it takes that away, that need. And also for students, if you ask my kids what their apprehension is to CPR, it's like, I have to do what? I have to kiss the guy? No, you don't. You don't have to. There's no mouth contact at all. And so for students, that overcomes a lot of the apprehension. And it turns out that 30-minute training is enough to show them how to give effective CPR.
Nicole, how expensive would this be to provide this training to, in effect, every student in Wisconsin of a certain age?
There are a lot of no-cost options available to the schools. So one of the things I think I'm most proud about with this legislation is it's not just the American Heart Association working on this. We've teamed up with the Red Cross, with the fire chiefs, with the police chiefs, with several hospital partners. There are so many community resources that we all have that are ready and willing and able to go into their local schools and do it at no cost to the school. In fact, I was just a couple of weeks ago in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, where the fire lieutenant goes in and he does the training for no cost. He brings the mannequins with him, spends the whole day there with the students, and it doesn't cost the school anything.
And Dr. Ralph, you mentioned the apprehension of doing anything. A bystander in this situation might not be confident enough to take action. This training helps overcome that reluctance?
Absolutely. Because, it's such a simple skill. Hands only to compressions. It's why it only takes 30 minutes to learn. And since it's so simple, it's something I think you can remember. And the fact that you've been in the situation where you've learned it and thought about it and talked about it, I think then when you're faced with it in life at some point, you're more likely to act because you know you can do something.
Nicole, according to my numbers, a lot of people in Wisconsin have left the 12th grade behind a long time ago. What kind of options are there out there for people to get trained if they're past school?
There are a lot of options. We do a lot of community CPR education efforts. We're in the malls a lot of the time. I know a lot of the local hospitals do training in the community. A lot of the American Heart Association events we have at Heart Walks and Go Red Luncheons, we're always training people in CPR. So there are many, many options out there.
And Dr. Ralph, I mean, you do pediatric heart health yourself. You've seen stories where CPR has made a difference?
Absolutely. We have several examples throughout the state, in this state alone, where CPR has been provided by bystanders and saved lives. They've been on the campus here at UW, up in Wausau, all over the place. There are survivors, people who are alive today because a bystander was there at the right time and provided effective CPR. These are people who are still fathers, still husbands, who are living their lives because of the fact that CPR was available.
And Nicole, briefly as we wrap up, what's the status of the legislation right now?
The legislation, we had a fantastic committee vote in the Assembly about a week and a half ago, and got a unanimous vote the following day out of the Assembly Public Safety Committee. We also had a hearing in the Senate recently. We're hoping to get a vote through there in the next couple of days and then on to the full floor in both houses.
All right, Nicole, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Dr. Ralph, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Great. Thank you for having us.
We've been talking to Dr. Jay Carter Ralph and Nicole Hudzinski. They're with the American Heart Association looking at a proposal to require CPR training for Wisconsin students. You can share your thoughts, by the way, and your experiences with CPR on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk to a former state lawmaker about Governor Walker's State of the State address last night.
First, getting a roundup of that State of the State speech from WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson. He joins us now from the state capitol. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, what were the highlights from last night's speech? What were the big newsmakers?
I guess if you look at new stuff that was introduced in the governor's speech, there wasn't actually a whole lot. I think you could say there were a couple proposals in there that were actually new. One of those was the governor floated this idea that we might move to a self-insurance plan in state government and use the savings plow the savings back into public education, into K-12 education. The thing with that is he didn't exactly endorse making that change. In fact, today he's saying he's not 100% for that. And even if he was, there are a couple competing studies out there. One says it would save the state money. One says it would cost the state a lot of money. So that's not exactly huge earth-shattering news, especially if the governor is not putting his full force behind it. Another thing that he talked about was working with the University of Wisconsin to explore providing a three-year degree that somebody could start on when they're in high school and finish in college. And then beyond that, he talked about a college affordability plan that he actually floated before the address that would allow for the full deduction of student loan interest on state income taxes and increase grants for technical colleges. But that was the new stuff. And beyond that, it was a longer speech than the governor has given in, you know, years past for a State of the State address. But even though it was longer, there wasn't a lot of new material in there. And even though this was his first speech since leaving the presidential campaign, there were still remnants of that presidential campaign stump speech in there. He hit a lot on those same themes that he's been hitting on for the past couple of years.
This was not a speech, and I think people were expecting this to be the case, actually. This was not a speech where a lot of big new vision, a lot of bold new ideas were coming, and nobody thought there would be.
He has a couple things, I guess, working against him there. I mean, a big one is that the legislature is only going to be in for another couple months this year, and that means they're only going to be actually on the floor of the legislature for, you know, counting today, I think maybe four or five more days in the Senate, maybe three more days in the Assembly. It's not a lot of time if you've got a big new idea to get it moved through the legislature, because it's an election year and they're going to get done here at the Capitol, and that'll basically be it as far as their time working on big stuff. And, you know, it's not a budget year for the governor, which is typically when you see the big proposals come out is in the budget. So, you know, I think you got to wait basically another year to find those.
There's no budget, and there's no budget reform bill where we've seen big splashes made with Act 10, for example.
No, but we did hear from Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald that we might see new budget numbers out soon that show that things aren't quite as good as Republicans had hoped. He said that doesn't mean that we're going to need to have kind of a budget repair bill. But if there's less money than the state was hoping for, he said that could affect what they pass in those remaining couple months.
Well, Sean, we'll be talking to you about that and I'm sure some of the last-minute flurry of legislation. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That was WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson giving us the details on last night's State of the State address. And now from the State of the State and beyond, 2016 is shaping up to be still a big year in Wisconsin politics. We've got a Supreme Court election, a lot of new bills, as we mentioned, in the state capitol, and national elections in November. Former Democratic State Senator Chuck Koala joins us now. He's currently the owner of Koala Law Offices and one half of The Insiders, a political talk show on WisOpinion.com. The other half of the team turned out not to be able to join us today, former Republican State Senator Ted Canevas. So, Chuck, you're flying solo. Thanks for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here, and it's great to have the Democratic message unfettered. Now, I'm sure that Ted is listening carefully and will get me on the next WIS Politics podcast.
And he can comment on the Central Time Facebook page and argue
there
with
you
via that.
There you go.
So we got that recap of last night's State of the State. Anything that struck you, anything that surprised you?
Well, I thought that, frankly, Scott Walker could have listed all the people in the state that he wasn't introducing. It would have taken less time. I mean, as your reporter, Sean, pointed out, there wasn't a lot of substance there. They spent a lot of time introducing people, which is a common thing that's happened now with, especially at state governments, even happens at the national level. And then he cited a lot of statistics that really were meaningless. You know, the old story that statistics lie. The reality is that we are a 30-something in Wisconsin. What is that? We're a 30-something in that we're always in the 30s in terms of the states, in terms of job creation. We're in the bottom half. We're in the bottom third oftentimes, sometimes in the bottom quarter in job creation. We are last, dead last in the Midwest. There's no amount of talking about the unemployment rate being low, et cetera, or the number of absolute number of people employed that will overcome the fact that we are just low in comparison to everyone else. And I think that he made a very strong effort to talk about how great the state was doing when, in fact, the statistics belie that.
Well, but the unemployment rate is low, lower than the national average. He referred to people on the left and in the media emphasizing the negative. That's a good number to see, the low unemployment rate.
Wisconsin almost always is lower than the national unemployment rate, and that's just kind of the nature of where we are in the Midwest, and that we aren't the high flyer and we don't have a lot of new growth in terms of population. One of the problems that we have, and this is one of the untold stories of the immigration debate, is that you actually need growth in population in order to have growth. And one of the reasons that you just heard Sean mention that the Republicans are thinking they're not going to have as much money in the budget. Well, why is that? That's because growth in Wisconsin is not what it should be. And so the problem is we don't have enough people coming into the workforce in order to grow our employment base. So you can have low unemployment but still not be doing well as a state, and that's right where Wisconsin is right now.
Well, another focus in the address last night, as Sean mentioned, was college affordability for people going into college, people in college, people out of college, and their student loan debt. He has a package there. Democrats saying yes, and we need to go a lot further than that. Do you see this as something that maybe the governor and Democrats and Republicans in the legislature can find some middle ground on, actually accomplish something that'll make a difference?
They should be able to, for this reason. This is not something Scott Walker wants to do. He knows that it is a burning issue out there. And the problem is that he is putting something on only because he knows that he has really, the Republicans are getting burned on this nationally. Young people understand that they are being cheated. They're paying a fortune for their education and they're not able to get jobs when they get out. Democrats know that this has to be addressed, and they're putting out some big plans. To be honest with you, and of course, remember, I'm a Democrat, this is very weak tea that Scott Walker's putting out there. Look at how much it costs to do what Scott Walker's suggesting. That will tell you how substantive the proposal is. He's proposing very little money. It's something to show that we are doing something without really doing something. What's the old Lonnie Anderson line? Is there anything I can do without really getting involved? That's kind of the Scott Walker prescription on student debt.
Now, a legislative session coming to a close pretty soon. Civil service reforms in the work, stem cell research bans, and lots of smaller pieces of legislation. People are, I think, stuff that's personal in some cases to a lot of lawmakers. Actually, let me ask you about that. You were in the legislature. Is there that thing like, okay, we've done the big stuff, folks. I've got this thing. I want to do it. Can we do this?
I can remember at least one legislator who absolutely had to pass something because he hadn't done anything for the last 2 years and had to get it done, no matter how small it was. And sometimes, you know, as a leader, you'll try to accommodate that as long as it doesn't hurt anybody, and maybe it's important to that lawmaker. But the reality is here, there are two things that maybe are worth talking about. One is the civil service reform. Oh, my goodness. Wisconsin, one of the untold stories about Wisconsin is we have a surprisingly small percentage of people in public service, and yet we get great service out of them. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Why are we messing with civil service? It's served us well in Wisconsin and in many places across the country. And I'll tell you what, I think it's just a continual march against public employees. Very disappointing, and particularly disappointing when you have things like the Wisconsin pension system that the governor's going after, which is maybe one of the best, if not the best in the country, or our civil service system, which provides us with a state and local government employee ratio to public people out there that is extraordinarily low, and we get great service. So that's really, really disturbing to me that they're going after that. What was the other one you mentioned?
Stem cell research.
Wow. Do we really want to brand Wisconsin as the place that is unwelcome to people who are researching in this area? I can't tell you how many people, when I was in the legislature and this was an issue, brought up the fact that if we can do something to help my mother or to help my child who has this dread disease, let's do whatever we can. And yet somehow we are going to be the state that is holding everyone back. Here we had Jamie Thompson on the cover of Time magazine years ago, and we're trying to say, no, we are not user-friendly when it comes to researchers at the University of Wisconsin dealing with stem cell research. That is about as bad as you can be on branding the state of Wisconsin. And whether it passes or not, the fact that we even have an opportunity to talk about it on this program is a really negative thing for Wisconsin and particularly the UW.
And one more policy item from State of the State, this idea, and it's been floated already, self-insurance, the state being its own insurance provider, in effect, for public employees. Early stages here, legislators not necessarily jumping on board, dueling studies out there. What do you make of where this one's going to go?
Well, I think Sean also, again, said we've only got a few sessions left, and this is not the time when you take on something controversial like this and get it done. But it's a really bad idea whose time will never come. You just hope that it doesn't happen in the next budget.
We're talking now with former Democratic State Senator Chuck Kuala about what to watch for in state politics this year, and you can join the conversation, too.
Are there any bills or new laws that you're keeping an eye on this year? What did you think of the governor's State of the State address last night? And how do you think Wisconsin will vote in state and national elections in 2016? Call us now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about things to watch for in Wisconsin politics this year, and we want to hear from you.
Are there any bills or new laws you're keeping an eye on this year? What did you think of the governor's State of the State? And looking ahead, how do you think Wisconsin will vote in the race for Senate, Supreme Court, the presidential race in primaries and in November? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation now with former Democratic State Senator Chuck Kuala. Before we move on to elections, we'll bring in some listeners. Ben is with us in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Two issues that I'm very concerned about. One of them is the attempt to reduce the protections involved in licensing new nuclear power plants. I think it's a terrible idea. Anybody who's been paying any attention to what happened in Fukushima in Japan knows that the government there is still dealing with the aftermath of that. The problems are proving intractable. They really don't have any sort of engineering solution for the radiation pollution that's taking place, even though they've tried everything they can think of. There are large areas that are still uninhabitable.
And Ben, what was the other issue you wanted to bring up?
Wisconsin. The other one is the change in the property tax law for forest in Wisconsin, which is a big giveaway to the lumber industry and heaps even more of the property tax burden onto residential property owners.
Ben, thanks a lot for the call. Chuck, let's start with nuclear power. We've had this, I don't know if it's technically a moratorium, but the restrictions are strict enough that, yeah, you can't build a nuclear power plant here. Maybe we're going to relax that. What do you think?
Well, it's an interesting topic, and it's not one where it absolutely breaks down on Republican-Democratic lines. And the reason for it is this. I mean, historically, for example, back in the early 80s, mid-80s, when I was around when some of these nuclear freezes and nuclear bans were being put on, the issue at that time was nuclear was dangerous, as it still is, and nuclear was also something that was a major corporate involvement. It's still a major corporate investment. It is not the same as solar or wind, where you might be able to do it on a smaller scale. But the thing that is bringing Democrats around to some extent, certain ones, is because the overriding issue of climate change. We just realized that we have to address the issue of our carbon footprint. And nuclear power is one thing that gets us away from that. The problem is you'd hate to think that we have to do it that way when solar is coming down and costs so much and wind is another viable option and we have so many other things that we can do, conservation, et cetera. But what's happened is that Democrats are not as opposed as they used to because they realize the climate change issue and the carbon footprint is so dramatic. Nuclear power is one way to get away from it. And that's the reason that Democrats, you're not seeing Democrats as viciously and strongly against it, but a lot of people who are concerned that this is another way that the electric industry and gas industry and the corporate elements will be able to control our energy future. So those are the balances. I think on balance, nuclear is still very expensive and still very dangerous. I think most of us would like to see us move more towards solar and other sources. But the carbon footprint thing is such a dominant issue. That's what's happening there.
And he also mentioned a change in tax laws related to forest land. Part of a wider issues, Republicans saying, hey, we're going to end some regulations, loosen regulations, give property owners more ability to do what they need to do, possibly create jobs, they say, while still protecting our conservation needs.
Well, on the forest, the caller is right. I mean, the reality is that all of the property tax continues to be dumped on the homeowner and the renter, frankly. And everybody else has their own exemptions, including the big timber industry. He's absolutely right. And this is part of that exemption that they're getting, which is and this is reducing regulations. You know, they're supposed to give access to people for hunting and other public uses. So, you know, WMC has all the manufacturing and machinery equipment exemption. I mean, every special interest has their exemption except for the homeowner. So the caller's right about that, and it's something to be addressed. The lack of regulation usually comes down to some special interest that's wanting to do something that isn't necessarily good for the public. Not always, and there are times when regulation is excessive, and I've certainly seen it. But more often, what we're dealing with is making sure that our water and our air is clean, and those are things we want to protect.
Take another caller now. Todd is with us in Montello. Todd, hi.
Hello. Hey, my concern is this bill that's before the Senate and the Assembly on a fast track, allowing aquaculture concerns to tap into streams, headwaters, spring waters, all kinds of different things without any limit to the amount of water they can use and abuse. And I'm just really concerned that, you know, our trout fishery, cold water fisheries are going to be irreparably damaged by some of these actions.
Todd, thanks for the call. Fish farming is not one. I'll level with you, Chuck. I haven't tracked this one. Have you?
Well, a little bit. And I think the caller is onto something that is really not visible. And these are the little things that happen that you really worry about because it could slip through. And the caller is absolutely right. We have this amazing thing in Wisconsin of these trout streams that are within 15 minutes of downtown Madison or at least the edge of Madison, Black Earth Creek, et cetera. And this is all throughout the state. So not all throughout, but southwest Wisconsin, many areas that have wonderful trout streams. And the ability of people to access in an unlimited way our water supply is a really dangerous proposition. And it has impacts far beyond just trout streams, but that's the most visible and first thing out of the box. As we go forward, water is going to become a more and more precious resource. We should not let entities be able to tap into that without any restrictions on them because that will give us problems in the long run. I think the caller's on to it, and frankly, it's not something that anybody's paying attention to.
Todd, thanks for the call. We're talking to former Democratic State Senator Chuck Koala about the year in politics. Now, let's tell a tale of three elections here. We've got a few coming up, biggies. State Supreme Court, it doesn't, conservative-liberal split, as the media describes it, doesn't hang in the balance here. Your thoughts on this race, though? This is a spring race.
It's still very important. I mean, people underestimate the importance of Supreme Court races. The turnout is lowest because it's a spring election. This is a rematch, some might say, of basically a referendum on Scott Walker. The previous election was David Prosser versus Joanne Kloppenburg, and Prosser won. In fact, many people thought Kloppenburg was going to win. In fact, I was one of those people who was watching the results, and she was slightly ahead, and all of a sudden from Waukesha County came in 15,000 votes, and the election shifted to Representative or to Justice Prosser. Awesome, yeah. I remember when he served in the Assembly. Now that race is coming back again with Rebecca Bradley, and it's her against Kloppenburg. Again, it's conservative versus progressive. Big money has now taken over Supreme Court races. The balance is not at stake. You're absolutely correct. But if progressives want any chance to at any time take over the Supreme Court in the near future, this is a critical race. And this may be another referendum on Walker. His popularity is down. If Kloppenburg wins, that means that you will not have a Republican governor next year. I would say that's about an 80 to 90% probability.
It's a bellwether election.
It will be a bellwether election. Now, if she loses, it doesn't mean you will still have a Republican, but it would be so overwhelming if she won that I think you would see the Republicans go out of power in the next gubernatorial election.
Moving ahead to November, Senate race, Russ Feingold, Ron Johnson, speaking of rematches.
It is a rematch, and I think you're going to see it flip. Russ Feingold is, I don't know how the election was lost. I guess I do know it was a wave Republican year. Ron Johnson has done nothing to distinguish himself in the Senate, and I think it's going to be Feingold by probably about 5%. And I think he'll run an effective race. And again, Ron Johnson is not impressing even Republicans in Washington, D.C.
And the big ticket, the presidential race, who does Wisconsin like in the two primaries, and who does it like in the runoff?
Oh, this I'll tell you, this is an amazing primary season. On the Democratic side, you're seeing the different elements of the Democratic Party defined by Bernie Sanders, who is the kind of the traditional left that says that it's economic populism versus what some people see as a more corporatist Hillary Clinton, but some people would say a person who focuses on other issues and wants to make sure that we run the country. An amazing resume, the first woman who will be president. If I had to bet, I'd say right now Hillary Clinton's going to be president. However, that's not looking like the way it is out in the polls. She's losing in Iowa, she's losing in New Hampshire, and she may lose in Wisconsin. And if that happens, we're going to have a different thing. The Republican side, I wish Ted was here to talk about it, but I'll tell you, Donald Trump, who would believe that the guy is still viable? I mean, is racism and bigotry really that popular in this country? I guess for some people it is, but I just have to believe that the Republicans will get away with that. We'll get away from that. If it's Trump versus Clinton, it's going to be a runaway. Hillary Clinton will win. If it's Trump versus Bernie Sanders, oh my God, you have the far right and the far left, and God help us if, from my perspective, if Donald Trump wins.
Chuck, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's former Democratic State Senator Chuck Kuala talking about what we can expect from the world of Wisconsin politics in 2016. If you're at a fast food restaurant, you might hear the question, do you want fries with that? No surprise. But then, do you want chocolate on those fries? Big surprise, unless you're in Japan.
That's right. The McDonald's chain in Japan is going to be testing chocolate-topped French fries starting next week with chocolate sauce or white chocolate drizzled on those fries. It's being sold as a dessert item with the name McChoco Potatoes.
I was skeptical until I heard the name. It's just fun to say McChoco Potatoes. Now, this was a huge controversy among your family, as I understand it, Veronica.
It was a hot topic. I'm not going to lie to you, Rob. At dinner last night, would you eat McChoco potatoes? I didn't know the name then, so I just said chocolate-covered fries. Mm-hmm. And we were split. Some people said, of course, it makes the fries moist and tasty, sort of a la poutine, you know, the Canadian thing with gravy, only French fries. And others saying, no, that's just violating all the laws of the universe.
So I get chocolate or caramel right with salty stuff. That's all. That's like in, and I love it. It's great. Some of my favorite ice cream flavors have that now. So far, so good. Potatoes. Put potatoes in the mix, and it just got too weird for me. I don't think I try it. You? Would you try it?
You're not an adventurous sort. We should say that.
It's
full
true.
Disclosure, I am. I would at least try a fry with chocolate.
All right, plane tickets to Japan. You will try them. I will watch you. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.